Hey, y'all. Welcome to Biscuits and Jam from Southern Living. I'm your host, Sid Evans. And today I'm talking to one of the most knowledgeable people I've ever met when it comes to whiskey. Fred Minnick was born and raised in the small town of Jones, Oklahoma, where he developed an interest in shooting, fishing, and messing around in the great outdoors. Inspired by his grandfather's military service, he enlisted in the National Guard while attending Oklahoma State University, eventually serving as an Army photojournalist in Iraq in 2004. The constant danger and random violence of being in a war zone, as well as the experience of losing friends and comrades, caused him to struggle with PTSD and depression after returning home. Now in his new book, Bottom Shelf, How a Forgotten Brand of Bourbon Saved One Man's Life, Fred tells the very personal story about how he clawed his way back from the brink of self-destruction. He chronicles his discovery of a hidden talent for tasting the complex flavors of wine and whiskey, and he shares how his obsession with the story of Old Crow Bourbon and its mysterious founder gave him a new sense of purpose. We'll discuss all that, plus the crucial role his wife played in his recovery, the best bourbon he's ever tasted, and his top recommendations for a Kentucky bourbon tour, all in this week's Biscuits and Jam. This episode includes mentions of suicide. If you or someone you know might be having thoughts of suicide, please consider reaching out to a suicide or crisis lifeline. In the United States, you can dial 988 for help. Fred Minnick, welcome to Biscuits and Jam.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Sid. I kind of wish I had some biscuits. I love a good biscuit and coffee.
Well, in this case, we're doing this in the afternoon and we actually have some bourbon, which right. is even better.
Yeah, you know, come to think of a bourbon and a biscuit and jam is quite delicious. I like a good southern ham on a biscuit with a little bit of jam on it. Goes great with especially like Four Roses or like a Maker's 46. Oh, it's very nice.
Well, we should have maybe planned a little better and had some biscuits.
Well, here's the thing, Sid. I'm trying to be healthy, you know, trying to like get myself in really good shape for like jiu-jitsu competitions and stuff. And the bourbon industry and the biscuits and jam, they kind of get in the way of that sometimes. So you gotta manage all that.
Yeah. It's all about moderation, right?
That's right. Yeah.
It's great to see you again. Last time I saw you was actually here in Birmingham. You know, now we had to do this remote, but where am I reaching you? At home in Louisville?
Yeah, I'm in Louisville right now in my office.
Okay. Well, it's a great looking office. Looks like a nice place to work from.
It looks much better than it really is. There's probably 5,000-6,000 bottles in here and you have to like literally walk around them because I have no place to put everything. It's a small office. I have so much whiskey in here. I have storage spaces outside of here. I've got other offices, but this is my main one. It is jam-packed with bourbon.
Well, I need to come pay you a visit there sometime.
Love that.
You have been busy, my friend. You've got a lot going on, and you've got this new book out, which is really terrific.
Thank you.
I finished it last night, and it's called Bottom Shelf, How a Forgotten Brand of Bourbon Saved One Man's Life. It's terrific, and it's actually, I think, the first book that you've done in a while. It's been a few years, right? You've written a lot of books, but this one is the first since probably, what, 2018 or something?
Yeah, 2018 was my last like new book. I've had second editions and I've had books translated into other languages. So it kind of felt like I had like a book presence, but this is the first like new book I've written. And this one, honestly, Sid, this one is my heart and soul. I get into some difficult stuff, right? You know, I'm an Iraq vet, and when I came home from the war in 2005, I was really broken, and I talk about that. And if not for my wife and the bourbon community, I don't think I pieced myself back together. And so that's kind of what the book's about in a lot of ways. Well, I'm on this journey of chasing down a brand of bourbon that to this day I love, but it also still kind of pisses me off a little bit. So.
Well, I mean, just the title alone, Fred, you know, there's a lot to unpack there. Bottom Shelf, How a Forgotten Brand of Bourbon Saved One Man's Life. Talk to me about bottom shelf. You know, what does that mean to you? And what did it mean to you when you kind of came up with that?
So the term, it's kind of a double entendre, right? So I was probably, you know, on the bottom shelf of my life when I kind of discovered bourbon in a way that was like in a professional set, you know, way. And I find a brand of bourbon called Old Crow, which, you know, was the greatest thing I'd ever tasted to that point and remains to be the greatest bourbon I've ever tasted. But it was from 1969. And when I went to go look for Old Crow, I was still green in the bourbon space. You know, I was a new reporter in the world. And I was expecting to see this bottle to be behind like the locked doors, way up top on the shelf, having some kind of limited edition price sticker next to it. But instead, it was on the bottom shelf for like $5-6 for a pint. People would come in who were drinking at 10 a.m. and chug it in the parking lot. That's what they were getting. You know, it was on the bottom shelf, and I was on the bottom shelf of my life. And that's kind of why that title like really, really resonated with me was, you know, people say you hit rock bottom, right? That's a pretty commonly used term. But for me, I don't think I hit rock bottom. I kind of feel like I was something that was always meant to be greater, and I was like stuck right there on the bottom shelf.
So, Fred, I want to come back to a lot of this. I mean, the story about the bourbon, and, you know, it's kind of a detective story. Mm-hmm. And also a little bit of your experience overseas in Iraq. But first of all, take me back to Oklahoma for a minute. You grew up in a small town in Oklahoma called Jones, Oklahoma, which I think is just sort of northeast of Oklahoma City.
That's right. Yep.
Talk to me about, you know, that town and what brought your family there.
Wow. My grandparents moved there from Ada, Oklahoma in like the 70s. And I think grandpa had like a job in Oklahoma City, and they chose to move somewhere that was not the city. It's pretty common in Oklahoma where if someone works in Tulsa or Oklahoma City, they find a place 45 minutes away. And, you know, back then they'd get in their old F-150, you know, put in Chris LeDoux tape or something like that and just drive all the way there, burn the heck out of gas mileage. But they would just drive to the job and then drive back. And that's kind of what my grandpa did. And my mom met my dad at a grocery store they worked at in Spencer, Oklahoma. And my mom was, I think, 17 when I was born. Dad was 16. They were very, very young.
Wow, Fred.
And they actually raised me in the house that my grandma and grandpa moved to when they moved there. So, yeah, my parents still live in that house, and all my family still lives in Jones and Choctaw, Oklahoma, all in that area.
So, you know, so much of your story is a story about food and drink and your discovery of that and how it kind of changed your life. Who was doing the cooking in your house growing up? What was an early experience of that that, you know, was meaningful to you?
Well, my mom definitely was the cook. We were eating like Hamburger Helper or something. She would cook, you know, we cooked a lot of bacon, right? And we also raised animals, and we would eat a lot of the animals, except the sheep. Mom would never let us eat sheep because they were too cute.
Uh-huh.
But we would eat our pigs like all the time.
So this was really kind of a farm setting.
You know, I guess in today's sense it was farm. I never felt like I grew up on a farm, but I had a farrowing house at my house, which is where like you raise, you know, sows, you know, birth pigs, and I would have boars and we had chickens, but I never felt like we really had a farm.
Hmm.
But it was at my grandparents. When I think about like my family's cooking, I think of the kind of like the old cast iron skillet, you know, that my grandpa would make cornbread in, any kind of like meat you could imagine. You know, there were stews, and we ate a lot of squirrel. We ate a lot of chicken. We ate a lot of the things that we would raise or we would like hunt or whatever. I wouldn't say I was a big hunter growing up, but I definitely would go around and bring in small game to eat at the house. And, you know, I remember grandpa frying rabbit, you know, cutting the rabbit up with his like little pocket knife that he'd had since he was like 12 years old and pan frying it. And that's the kind of cooking we had. And I would say that there was never anything fancy, but it was always rich.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that would be like a couple ingredients, butter or grease. And back then we thought that wasn't very healthy, but now we know that butter and like animal fat's actually not that bad for you.
But flavorful too.
Very flavorful. Yeah. Very flavorful.
Yeah. You're known for your palate and having a kind of a remarkable ability to discern very distinct flavors.
Well, thank you.
And is that something that you were kind of aware of?
No, I was not aware of me having any skill whatsoever of smelling or tasting. Like, I know when I was growing up, I could smell things, and so could my mom. Like, everyone in my family, we could smell stink a mile away. Like, we would be driving, and we could smell like some farmer laying down sludge 5 miles out. And I never thought anything of that. It wasn't really until I went through taste mindfulness exercises that I realized I had like a natural ability for smelling, which would lead to tasting too. But, you know, the whole family on my mom's side can smell at a very, very high level. And I never thought anything of that until my recovery.
Well, it's clearly served you well. And, of course, I think it's also probably a little bit like a muscle that you have to kind of train and you can develop.
I tell you what, it doesn't work out when you're near smelly people.
Yeah.
We've been in like Target or somewhere like that. I'll look over at my wife. I'm like, oh, my God, do you smell that? She's like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And then three aisles later, she's like, oh, I smell it now.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Doesn't always serve you well.
No.
Well, Fred, so I want to ask you about a decision that set you on this path that changed your life in a lot of ways. You enlisted in the National Guard when you were, I think, were you at Oklahoma State?
Yep, that's right. I was at Oklahoma State. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you're a veteran. We were talking about this a minute ago, and obviously that's just been such a huge part of your whole, your journey, your life experience. Take me back to that kid who made that decision and what was going through your mind when you decided to join the reserves.
So when I enrolled at Oklahoma State, I was very young. So I actually enrolled at like 17. I was there and I had just turned 18. So I had the ability to make the decision myself. And we're walking through student union, and there's an Army National Guard recruiter there. I had always played with G.I. Joes. My grandpa was in the military. I'd always loved all the military movies. I loved, you know, shooting, fishing. I loved all that stuff as a kid. And I wrestled, so I had like this desire to do dumb things, I think. And looking back, that's the quintessential description of a lot of the military, is that you just like doing stuff. They were advertising free college. And I was like, well, you know, yeah, I've always wanted to do this. Let's see what it's like, you know? And so I went up to the recruiter. I was like, hey, I want to do this, but I don't want to peel potatoes. I hate feeling certain things. Like I hate touching ice, and I hate the feel of peeling a potato. Like the texture of it just kind of gives me like weird goosebumps. And he's like, oh, no, they don't do that anymore. They got machines for that. So I was like, all right, I'm in. And so I signed up. And, of course, within like a week of being in the military, I'm at basic training and I'm peeling potatoes. And that recruiter found me. He just laughed his ass off. He's like, that was the dumbest thing anyone's ever asked. I was like, oh, sorry. But it was a combo of like really wanting to serve my country and being drawn to the fact that my school would be paid for.
Yeah. And some family history too.
Yeah. Yeah. A little family history there.
So you served in Iraq
as
an Army public affairs officer, right?
Yeah. So I was an Army photojournalist. And basically what I did was I was attached to all kinds of military units from civil affairs to special forces, a lot of just random infantry units. And we'd basically go out on patrols. We would knock down doors in the middle of the night. Basically, my entire job was to document operations. This is before everyone had like a GoPro on their head. And so as a country, we needed documentation for a lot of the things that we were doing. And so that was part of my job. The other part of it is like the photos would be used for the media. So my imagery would get released to the media through a network, through the Defense Imagery System. And then sometimes I would write stories about the people I was out with and send it to their local newspapers.
Well, I've seen pictures of you over there riding around in the back of a pickup truck or some kind of a Humvee or something, but you're holding this kind of very old school camera. I feel like there's one where there's a gun mounted in the back of the truck and you're just in the middle of everything.
You probably saw an image of like a 50 cal with like no armor, very, very much exposed.
Yeah.
That was the year that Donald Rumsfeld said, you go to war with the army you have, not the army you want. And we felt that very much. And we were out there duct tape holding a lot of the stuff together. But yeah, everywhere I went, I was armed. I mean, I had an M16 full capacity of rounds and basically I'd get shot at a lot, always go near car bombs. And it was just a constant. It was an absolute constant, walk one way and you live, walk another way and you're hit with a mortar.
Mm.
I mean, there were people who would be on the base and just walking to their living quarters and would get hit by a mortar, or a rocket. In 2004, it was just constant.
And completely random.
Yeah, I mean, there would be concentrated attacks, but this is the point of the war that the Iraqi military had obviously been defeated and they were scattered throughout and had formed cells. There were new leaders coming in from other countries to organize against the U.S. military. And then you had the people like Al Sadr, who had large military units that could impose a real military approach toward United States. And so that's what a lot of it was. It was mostly guerrilla warfare, some larger units, but a lot of random explosions. There would be somebody driving a car and would have a mortar tube in the car and they would fire it and then they would skirt off, a lot of things like that.
Mm. Fred, I want to say here that this is a very hopeful story and it's a very positive story and inspiring in a lot of ways. But, you started in a rough place. I mean, you start this story. You've come back from serving over there. You've got PTSD and depression. And the prologue of the book is actually called Rock Bottom. Why did you want to start the story there?
Well, I had to start it there because that was truly the moment where I said, I can't, I have to change. I don't know how I could have described it other than just describing it, right?
Yeah.
If I said I made an attempt on my life in a sentence, I don't feel like that did the moment justice or what my wife did to keep me on this earth justice.
Mm-hmm.
So I just kind of, and it's also people have to understand, the book is also, in my heart, it's also a love story to my wife and everything that she's done for me. And that is the moment where I knew that I had failed her and I couldn't do it again. I had to stand up and I had to rise up from whatever was happening to me and fix myself. So that's really why I started there. And I know it's going to be hard for a lot of people to read. Believe me, it was 1,000 times harder than I thought to write. Mm-hmm. And this is actually my very first time to talk about it. So I still don't know how to talk about it, but I know it's important. And I know that, there's a lot of people who think that they're in a situation they can't get out of. And there's a situation where life isn't worth living anymore. And it's just my hope that one person hears this or sees me and says, you know what? Today's the day. I'm going to pick myself up and I'm going to figure it out. And that's it. That's it. That was the day I picked myself up. I made the declaration. I'm going to figure it out. I had no idea what it was going to be. I didn't know where I was going to go, but I knew that I had a woman in my life that loved me and I have to be there for her.
Jacqueline clearly played a huge role in getting you back on track. And I'm wondering if she also play a role in this book and kind of helping you tell this story, because, you know, there's so much that you needed to get down and she's such a critical person in it.
I definitely had to prod her on moments just to remember. I'm like, hey, do you remember this? Like, yeah, actually that sounds right. Or do you remember it this way? And she's like, I remember it this way. You know, so there were a lot of things like that. And one of the areas was when we were going through our woes of trying to have children and some of the things that were happening there, I remembered a detail about the doctor that she didn't remember. We had this conversation about that moment and just how painful it was and how we got through that. So writing this book helped us remember some of the most beautiful moments of our marriage. And it does center around food. A lot of it centers around food, you know, getting to have some of the best, most incredible meals you could possibly imagine at a place that's no longer open called Corbett's. Yeah. So having her read this and for lack of a better term, fact check me on things, that was absolutely pretty special to get to relive those moments.
Well, I loved how, you were kind of going through this process of discovery together and, you know, when you were younger and you hadn't gotten into bourbon yet, but there was something going on with food and tasting things and wine, and it was kind of bringing you some life that you needed, and you were sort of discovering that together. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, she was far ahead of the game on me with tasting, you know, high level cuisine. You know, I mean, she grew up in a house where her father was making Coq au Vin on a regular. You know, and her mom of Lebanese descent would have kibbeh every month, you know, when they have the family over. So she had a leg up on me in some of the cuisine. Although I would say I probably had a lot more rabbit and squirrel than she did growing up. So,
well, let me ask you about bourbon and your discovery of that. And in particular, you know, I said earlier, I mean, this is kind of a detective story, and you became obsessed really with James Crow and his story.
Yeah.
What was it about his story that resonated with you? Why did you find it so fascinating and want to pursue it?
Well, I think so many people in bourbon are fascinating. Just a random bottler at Jim Beam has a story. Everyone in bourbon is fascinating. And there's all of these stories and all of these histories out there that include E.H. Taylor, George T. Stagg, Jacob Beam from back in the day, the Samuels, you know, Bill Samuels. There's so many of these people who are heralded and talked about because their lineage lived on, right? So the stories are told by their sons and daughters and grandsons and on and on and on. James Crow didn't have that. He had a single daughter who passed away really not too long after he did. This man is heralded as the guy who introduced sour mash to the industry. I noted that in one of my books, Whiskey Women, that a woman by the name of Catherine Spears Fry Carpenter actually had a sour mash recipe in her Bible, dated 1818. But he is the one who, without a doubt, brought it to the industrial side. And without a doubt, we know in the 1840s and 1850s, he was the most sought-after distiller, and his name was actually branded in the barrels, and people were seeking out what they called Crow whiskey. You could make the argument that bourbon as we know it could be called Crow whiskey. Now, you could also make the argument it could be called Beam because of the influence that the Beam family had with so many Beams out there. But there was not a singular individual that had more of an impact on how whiskey was made in the 1800s than James C. Crow. That we absolutely, without a doubt, there was like no like detailed history on him. There was only what you could find through the advertisements. Brown-Forman did a pretty good job of telling his story as it related to the facilities of LeBron Graham that is now Woodford Reserve. But because they didn't own it, like, they only told the story of James C. Crow as far as it extended to them, which, hey, nothing wrong with that. They got to sell Woodford Reserve. I get that. But I'm over here thinking to myself, what's up with this guy? Why don't we know more about him? And I would look in encyclopedias, and it was everything was regurgitating the same stuff. It just started feeling like someone had taken a press release or testimony or whatever and just kind of ran with it verbatim, and it got recycled over and over and over again. And I would end up going through lawsuits to find materials on him. I hired researchers in Scotland who were specialized in finding genealogy, because there were multiple people at various points that were pointed to be as James C. Crow. You wouldn't know this, Sid, but James Crow is actually a pretty popular name back in 1820. It was like John Smith today. It's like, woo, a lot of James Crows back then.
Well, Fred, I just have one more question for you.
Yes, sir.
What does it mean to you to be Southern?
For me, like, I grew up in Oklahoma, and when I lived in Wisconsin for a little bit, everyone called me Southern. And I was like, I don't know if I'm Southern. And then, oh, yeah, you're Southern. And I was like, okay. And then I moved to Kentucky. And when I'd go to Alabama or, you know, somewhere like Florida, they're like, oh, no, you're not Southern. You're an Okie, or you're from Kentucky. That's not Southern. So if I'm Southern, I feel like, you know, I need you to crown me as such, Sid, because I don't feel like I've ever been properly anointed as Southern. Even though I'm a Kentucky colonel, I don't feel Southern.
Okay, well, let's just say right here and now that Fred Minnick is a Southerner.
How about I love that? It.
Okay.
I love it. Well, then I've always loved grits, and I've eaten more of the crazy Southern things that you can possibly imagine. I love alligator. You know, for those in Georgia and Florida,
Louisiana.
I think alligator's very tasty. I think what the Southern culture means is that you can listen to people. And that is probably my biggest takeaway of always spending time in the southern states. Even when I was in the forestry industry and I would go through the Georgia pines with foresters, like, people in the South have an innate ability to listen to you. And I think that's rare in today's social media world. And I've seen it with the kids in the South too. They listen. So I think that's special. And I think over the years I've listened and I've tried to listen and try to lend my ear to people. And so I think to be Southern, I think it means you listen to people.
Well, it's been great listening to you, Fred. And I really appreciate the time. And
no, thank you, Sid.
Congrats on the book. It's a terrific book. And really, really powerful. You have a really remarkable story, and it's beautifully told in this book. So congrats on that, and best of luck with everything down the road.
I appreciate that, Sid. I really do. I love Southern Living. My grandma still subscribes to it. It's the she's been a subscriber, I think, for probably 30 or 40 years. The fact that I'm in here rubbing elbows with you will go a long way in my family. Thank you.
All right. Well, cheers, Fred.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Fred Minnick. Southern Living is based in Birmingham, Alabama. You can also find past episodes and more online at southernliving.com/biscuitsandjam. Our theme song is by Sean Watkins of Nickel Creek. I hope you'll join me next week when my guest will be the country music superstar and food TV personality, Trisha Yearwood. We'll see you then.